Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika-Martin of Peace Action, who discusses the rising danger of U.S. war with Iran after President Trump violated the International Iran Nuclear Agreement and installed his new war cabinet. Bishop John Selders and Muslim chaplain Nora Fitzpatrick, who spoke about the issues of systemic racism and poverty at a Poor People's Campaign action in Hartford, Connecticut. And Candace Clement of the media democracy group Free Press, who talks about the recent victory in the U.S. Senate to overturn the Trump administration's repeal of net neutrality rules and the effort now underway to pass the same legislation in the House. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Three-quarters of a million Rohingya Muslims who fled massacres in Myanmar face a potential health crisis as monsoon season arrives in Bangladesh. Refugees who fled violence in Myanmar are now endangered by the prospect of disease, landslides, flash floods, and death, according to Foreign Policy magazine. Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh are located on some of the most flood and cyclone-prone regions in the world. Humanitarian aid groups are gearing up for monsoon season, but remain underfunded and unprepared for a long stay by the Rohingyas. While two rounds of cholera vaccination campaigns have been undertaken in the refugee camps, aid workers fear that a cholera outbreak may be inevitable due to poor sanitation and water quality. The group WaterAid Bangladesh warns that a cholera outbreak in the densely populated camps could kill thousands of people. The charity Doctors Without Borders is already setting up oral rehydration centers to treat cholera. The effects of the monsoon season could get worse if aid agencies don't secure more funding soon. In March, aid organizations launched a joint response plan seeking more than $950 million for 2018. However, as of now, the response has been only 16% funded toward the goal. Trillions of dollars of dark money move through the British territories in the Caribbean. The Panama Papers report that exposed global tax havens revealed hundreds of shell companies in the British Virgin Islands, including the Cayman Islands. The British Parliament, in early May, approved a measure supported by both Conservative and Labour members to create a register of the true owners of companies that incorporated in the British territories. 2 years ago, Britain became the first nation to establish a public registry of its corporations. The European Union recently issued a directive requiring all 27 EU nations to institute public registries by the year 2020. New U.S. legislation increasing corporate transparency has advanced in the House of Representatives. In 2016, the Obama administration initiated a pilot program by the Federal Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN, requiring title companies to identify the real owners behind shell companies used to buy pricey residences in Manhattan and Miami. Thus far, FinCEN has found that about 30% of the transactions have involved people who have been flagged in prior bank reports for suspected money laundering or fraud. As Amazon made a short list of cities for locating its second corporate headquarters, the retail giant's home city, Seattle, adopted a new head tax on large employers, including Amazon and Starbucks, to fund solutions to Seattle's escalating housing and homelessness crisis. In mid-May, Seattle City Council voted 9-0, approving a scaled-back tax on big employers with gross revenues over $20 million a year. Only 3% of companies in Seattle would be hit by the tax, which is estimated to raise $45 million annually. A debate on how to spend the tax revenue pits Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, who wants the funds spent on emergency shelters and clearing out homeless encampments, against progressive city council members who favor a long-term strategy of building affordable housing and moving away from the city's focus on emergency solutions. Seattle declared a homeless emergency in 2015, but unchecked real estate speculation keeps pushing rents up and pushing people, especially people of color, out of the city. Between 2015 and 2017, the rate of homelessness in the city grew by 44%. On a single night in 2017, over 11,000 homeless people were counted in Greater Seattle. With the new head tax, Seattle is now mandated to move 7,500 people out of homelessness by the end of the year. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
With the May 17th Senate confirmation of Gina Haspel, President Trump's pick to head the CIA, the administration's installation of a new war cabinet is complete. Haspel, who oversaw the torture of U.S.-held detainees after 9/11 and destroyed video evidence of that torture, was a disturbing choice to head the spy agency, given that Trump has aggressively advocated the reestablishment of torture, despite U.S. and international law that classifies torture as a war crime. Earlier, the president replaced National Security Advisor General H.R. McMaster with extreme war hawk John Bolton, who's on the record as a strong supporter of George W. Bush's disastrous Iraq War, called on Israel to launch a nuclear strike against Iran, and more recently encouraged the U.S. bombing of both North Korea and Tehran. Trump's cabinet reshuffling also replaced ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson with former Republican Congressman Mike Pompeo, who moved from his lead role at the CIA to be confirmed as U.S. Secretary of State. Pompeo, also with a reputation as a war hawk, has promoted regime change in North Korea and Iran. Bolton and Pompeo both have close links to hate groups that espouse Islamophobic views. Given that these high-level appointments harbor a deep disdain for diplomacy and have a long history of promoting military solutions to solve international disagreements, concern has grown that the Trump administration's future actions could lead to war. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, Senior Director for Policy and Political Affairs with Peace Action. Here he discusses the risk of unintended consequences emanating from Donald Trump's new war cabinet and the challenge of reviving the U.S. peace movement.
It's the highest level of concern about war with Iran that I had since the Bush administration. I started working on the issue of Iran a little bit after the Iraq War was sort of winding down. A lot of us was concerned because we were hearing rumblings that Vice President Cheney was starting to organize similar types of intelligence, similar types of people that he had did on Iraq, on Iran. Since working on that, that kind of helped build some of the building blocks to when the next president came, which was Obama, who was willing to try to figure out another way of engaging Iran. That sort of led into the Iran agreement, which was many, many years of negotiations and figuring out how to best move forward with Iran in an international way, not just between the U.S. and Iran, but with international community, the P5 plus one. So you had Russia, China, France, Great Britain, the U.S. and Germany working together to find an agreement to take some steps that would make everyone safer. And the Iran agreement definitely did that. It didn't take care of every issue because you don't usually do that, but it did block all the pathways that Iran had to any type of nuclear weapons. Some of those pathways were blocked permanently. They actually poured cement into one of their nuclear reactors that could have produced fissile material to build nuclear weapons. Cement was poured into that. You don't reverse that. And then they had the largest, most intrusive verification and inspections regimes that any country has ever been in. So we took this, which, Iran, if it had so chose, could have had a crude nuclear device in maybe 3 or 4 months when the agreement happened, to it would take well over a year, and we would know about it because we have all these monitoring systems. Now that's been thrown out the window. As it stands, Iran is continuing to abide by the agreement. How long that's going to last, we don't know. Now we're facing these threats to Iran and how they will react, it's very unclear. And anyone who was very concerned about the Iraq war, Iran has significantly more resources, significantly more military power. Any kind of military intervention that had to do with Iran is going to make a huge conflagration in the Middle East, because now you're going to bring in other countries, perhaps such as Saudi Arabia and Israel. It'd be a horrific mess. There is no military solution to Iran. Any military planner will show you how challenging that would be, how many deaths would occur, how much cost in blood and treasure that would happen. So I am concerned, because now we do have people such as Bolton and such as Pompeo, who have both said they want to see a regime change in Iran, and especially Bolton, who's been paid by a terrorist group called the MEK, which was for a long, long period of time on the terror watch list in the United States, and then was taken off by pressure under the Bush administration. He's been paid by them to foment intervention into Iran.
Given the threat of war that's in the air now with recent moves by the Trump administration, what can be done to revive the peace movement that was very strong and in the streets by the hundreds of thousands and the millions in the lead up to the Iraq War in 2002 and 2003? The peace movement has faded in recent years. What is it that you're doing at Peace Action to try to alert folks that the need to prevent a new war could be in the offing and that people have to be reactivated?
Yeah, I think some of the challenge is the people who were out in the streets for stopping the Iraq war, stopping Afghanistan war, are now out in the streets about immigration. They're out in the streets about saving health care. They're out in the streets about all these attacks that we have on various issues, and some of them are just more visceral. You know, when you have a friend that's being deported, or when you can't get health care or other issues, I mean, those kind of take the front of your vision rather than, oh, yeah, wars abroad is kind of further away. And especially now when more war is being fought with drones or missiles rather than troops on the ground, it's less visceral. So I think that people just need to realize that spending $1 trillion on the military, which is about to get voted on in the House of Representatives this week, affects all these other issues that you care about. If we end up going to war, the cost, the $6 trillion that we've already spent on other wars, those costs affect all these other issues that we care about.
That was Paul Kavika Martin, Senior Director for Policy and Political Affairs with Peace Action. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's war cabinet and the rising danger of new U.S. conflicts abroad by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Connecticut is one of about 40 states participating in a 40-day series of actions called the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Each state is holding an action in its capital city on six consecutive Mondays between May 14th and June 23rd. Each Monday's action will focus on a different priority issue, such as poverty, racism, and the environmental crisis. The Monday protests include an element of civil disobedience. In Hartford, Connecticut, on the first two Mondays, the action began with a few brief speeches and some singing, followed by a short march to a busy intersection in front of the Capitol building, where people blocked the street, some of whom were subsequently arrested when they refused to move. Those arrested were charged with disorderly conduct and are scheduled for upcoming court dates. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the first two actions in Hartford, including one on May 21st, which focused on systemic racism and immigration issues. We hear excerpts of two speeches delivered that day, first from Bishop John Selders, one of three co-chairs of the state's Poor People's Campaign, followed by Muslim chaplain Nora Fitzpatrick.
Poverty has been engineered.
Yes.
That in fact our form of economic democracy needs poor people in order to have rich people.
Yes.
So we have gathered in this space and place with our colleagues not just here, but all across the United States, right now in at least 30 states across the country and the District of Columbia. Our friends are gathering in similar spaces and places to decry that we will not go away.
Yes.
That this time we are fighting poverty to stay. We are part of the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who gathered a number of organizations and groups across the country 50 years ago, naming the triplets of evil for this country at that time: racism, materialism, and militarism. We have gathered under the banner of the Poor People's Campaign a national call for a moral revival. And we say there are five pillars that we have gathered around. Yes, racism, while things have changed, things are still the same. Racism still is a problem in this country. Can I get one amen right here?
Amen.
Poverty is still a problem in this country. Can I get one more amen right there?
Amen.
The war economy is still a problem in this country. Can I get one right there?
Amen.
54% of our national budget goes to the spending on national defense. That ain't right. It is very clear to me that ecological devastation impacts us all. And then there is the fifth of our pillars, which says, listen, there is a distorted understanding of what morality really is. I've said it once, I'll say it again here today. We spend a whole lot of time on what a certain person tweets rather than what I think are the real issues of this democracy. And so we're gathered here under that umbrella to do business. 40 days of moral direct action. We will take, a number of us will do once again what we have vowed to do. We have vowed not to let one more national and or in this case here in Connecticut statewide election happen without some focus on poor people and marginalized people and people who are disenfranchised. No more debates happen. No more conversations about what are the solutions for our state without a conversation about poor people and about people who are disenfranchised, about people who have the lack of health care and the lack of housing and the lack of jobs. Today we have singled out as the theme of this week's moral action is systemic racism. Say it, systemic racism. Systemic racism. We have a saying and a slogan in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, that systemic racism is immoral. Come on, say it with me. Systemic racism is immoral. We're also talking about immigration, the continued struggle people are having, first of all, just to get in here, but then once they're here, all the blocks that are placed in their way to stay here. Can I say that's immoral?
That's immoral.
Come on, sis. Talk to us a little bit about what it feels like to be Muslim in this, our fair land.
My name is Chaplain Noor Fitzpatrick. I'm an inner city ghetto chaplain, and I serve homeless youth living in the north end of Middletown, Connecticut. Today I'm gonna read from an urban dictionary, if you don't mind. Islamophobe. Islamophobes are people who believe that Islam promotes violence, barbarism, terrorism, persecution, women oppression, and fill any bad objective that you can think of. To prove their point, they indulge in either one or more of the following. They will present references from the Islamic scriptures with their own twisted translation. And I can go on and on and on. Don't fear people who wear hijabs. This is a hijab. It's a scarf. Shout out to all my hijabis in America. This is a decision that we make every day when we wake up to put on for the sake of God. So today my message to you is, don't fear Muslims. When you see them, talk to them, have a conversation with them, reach out to them, shake their hand. And I'll leave you with this. I was discriminated against once a couple years ago based on my scarf and the fact that they believed I am Muslim. And it was very heart-wrenching. It was my first experience in this country, and I'm ashamed of it. And I'm here today to say that we will not stand for this in our country. I'm here to tell you that as a Muslim woman who was raised Roman Catholic and Baptist, we ain't here for that. And we want you to stand with us as we stand with you and all the poor people in America. And on that note, God bless everyone who's here today. And please continue to pray for our homeless youth that are living in Middletown, Connecticut.
That was Muslim chaplain Noor Fitzpatrick and Bishop John Selders speaking in Hartford, Connecticut during the second week of actions organized by the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Learn more about the Poor People's Campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. By a vote of 52-47 on May 16th, the U.S. Senate voted to overturn the Federal Communications Commission repeal of net neutrality rules. The vote, taken under the Congressional Review Act, or CRA, now moves the debate on the fate of net neutrality to the House of Representatives, where the legislation faces a tougher fight. In December 2017, the FCC, dominated by Trump appointees, rescinded the Obama-era net neutrality rules, which had been adopted in 2015. The net neutrality regulations established then declared that broadband internet was an essential public utility and prohibited internet service providers like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon from slowing down or blocking certain websites and from charging users additional fees to access specific content. A national coalition of more than 200 groups and companies supporting a free internet organized a flood of calls and emails to senators, which helped win the recent vote. Now that same coalition is attempting to repeat their success in the House. However, many observers point out that even if net neutrality defenders win in the House, it will be extremely difficult to secure a two-thirds vote majority to overcome an expected veto from President Trump. Your reporter spoke with Candace Clement, campaign director with the media democracy group Free Press. Here she talks about the recent Senate vote and the effort now underway to pass the same legislation in the House.
We won a huge victory in the Senate this past week. And yeah, now this fight moves on to the House, where indeed it will definitely be tough. But the Senate victory was really a great example of how much momentum this issue has. You know, we saw every Democrat in the Senate vote for this. We saw three Republicans cross the aisle to join the Democrats on this. You don't see a lot of that happening these days in Congress. And that's really because, you know, members of Congress realize how much this issue matters to their constituents and to their voters, particularly in this election year that we're in.
Thank you for that, Candace. As I understand it, the repeal of net neutrality rules, those rules take effect June 11th. Tell us about the clock that's ticking on the House of Representatives and what happens if the House fails and Trump fails to sign legislation that reverses the FCC ditching of net neutrality rules.
So you're absolutely right. The repeal of the rules is set to go in effect on June 11th. And, you know, the House needs to move on this quickly, and you know they can vote on the CRA anytime this year. But I think in an election year, we all sort of know what the timeline looks like for, you know, Congress getting things done. And in terms of what that impact is going to be on people, you know, I think the tricky thing about how the cable and phone companies will respond to this and start rolling out, you know, net neutrality violations is that it might not be so immediately obvious where, you know, you go online one day and then, you know, on June 12th, suddenly, you know, Comcast lets you know that if you want to access Facebook, you got to pay an extra $15 a month. I think it might end up being something more sinister. It might take us a long time to figure out what they're actually doing because there's not a lot of transparency when it comes to how they conduct their behavior around things like this. So it's a very important battle in the House, and we're going to be doing everything we can, and we need everybody out there who cares about the future of the internet and making sure that it doesn't turn into cable television to do everything they can, too, to put pressure on members of the House to make sure that they do the right thing and vote the right way here. And another avenue that exists for us is Free Press is one of many organizations and companies that are suing the FCC over their decision from last year. We have a track record of success winning in the courts on this issue, but the timeline for that is very much unknown at this point.
We have these giant telecom companies, AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon, that operate as internet service providers and have lobbied Congress to get rid of these net neutrality rules.
What do we know about their campaign to stop the forward motion of yours and other groups' efforts to reinstate net neutrality?
You know, something that's been so funny, I've been working on this issue for 10 years now, and to see the way that these cable and phone companies have embraced the term net neutrality over the last couple of years is extremely amusing. So you'll see these companies issuing statements saying that they're supportive of net neutrality, that they just want to seek a legislative solution, and by that they mean they want Congress to introduce some sort of new law that would inevitably involve something that looked absolutely nothing like the net neutrality rules we won late last year. Members of Congress do take a lot of money from cable and phone companies and from telecom companies. And so it's definitely something that we have to push back against. And it means that we have to be even louder. We have to call their offices even more frequently. We've got to show up at candidate forums and events and talk to them about this issue and make sure that they really know. And I think that it's because people have been doing that and doing that so aggressively for the past few years that we were able to win net neutrality rules in the first place and that we were able to achieve such a huge victory in the Senate last week. So you can check out our website, which is freepress.net. There is also another great website that we are a part of and work in partnership with a couple of other organizations, Fight for the Future and Demand Progress in particular, called Battle for the Net, which is battleforthenet.com. There's so many other organizations that are doing great work on this. We're also a member of the Voices for Internet Freedom Coalition, which is a coalition of organizations that are working to, talk about the issues of internet freedom from the perspective of people of color. So there's a lot of great stuff out there. Definitely check it out, get involved, and there's lots of work to be done. So we'd be very excited to have you in the fight.
That was Candace Clement, campaign director with the media democracy group Free Press. Learn more about the effort to restore net neutrality rules by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in East Orland, Maine, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.